everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I think the Republican Party of late has lost its way. I think we're walking toward the most certain financial storm in the history of our country.
Another challenger arises to take on Trump. Republican candidate for president Mark Sanford tells us why he thinks he has a shot. Then,
have I reached the party to whom I am speaking?
The legendary Lily Tomlin joins us with her partner in comedy and in life, Jane Wagner. Plus, are we abandoning the children who want access to an affordable college education?
The message that we're sending to these students is you're on your own. This is not our job to take care of this. This is your own problem.
Author Paul Tough reveals how college can make or break us.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. And now there are three. Mark Sanford has become the third Republican to challenge President Trump in his own backyard, the former governor of South Carolina announcing his bid for president this week. A fiscal hawk, Sanford is setting out his stall as a Republican looking to get back to traditional conservative values, like cutting the deficit. But Trump might not be sweating just yet because polls still place his support at around 85% within the Republican Party. On top of that, the GOP is cancelling some primaries altogether to help ensure the president does get the nomination. Skipping the primaries so far, Arizona, Kansas, Nevada, and South Carolina, Mark Sanford's home state, which he's represented as governor and congressman. And he's joining me now from Charleston. Governor, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
Okay, so with all of that, with this, you know, quite a lot of obstacles there to clear, why do you think this is your time?
Because literally, if not now, then when? I do earnestly believe that we are walking ourselves toward quite the financial storm. And the friends that had encouraged this, their point was, we can't wait another 5 years to have this national debate on where we go next as a country on debt and deficit and spending. And, you know, it's once every 4 years that we have the chance, really, as Americans to debate what it means to be a Republican, what it means to be a Democrat, where we want to go as Americans at large. And so I think, one, now is the time, and two, budget and financial issues are actually something that I actually have a lot of experience on. When I was governor, I inherited a $1 billion financial hole in coming into office and dealt with that. I was the first governor that actually pushed back against the then-president stimulus package. I was the governor noted for carrying two pigs into the state house, decrying pork over a constitutional mandate. I was on the budget committee when I was in Congress. It's something that I know a bit about, and I think, again, we're at a tipping point that needs to be talked about.
Okay, so we're going to get into this whole deficit situation, because I want to know, is that your main pitch to voters? And is that what you think in this day and age, in these times, voters actually are going to connect with? And let me just ask you, in the context of what your own hometown newspaper has said of this bid, facing monumentally long-shot odds, former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford announced Sunday that he'll challenge fellow Republican President Donald Trump for the White House. So the lead is monumentally long-shot odds. You know, they say it's quixotic.
Well, they say it's tough, and I would acknowledge that. I mean, you look at the history since the 1950s in the United States of America, it has not worked out well for the challenger to a sitting president in terms of challenging nomination. But in every one of those instances, those challengers either change the course of that presidential debate in the nomination process, or frankly, they change the occupant in the White House. In that, because of a primary challenge, the incumbent went on to lose. And so I do think you can have much more effect than you might realize at the front end. I've said up front that it's a long shot. I know that going in. But again, I think it's worth the conversation on behalf of my four sons and a lot of other kids that are and grandkids that are out there based on the debt and deficit problem that I'm trying to elevate. But I also think that there are some other issues that are important in terms of where we go as a Republican Party. Do we now, does it mean to be a Republican you're looking inward versus outward? Do we believe in free trade, which used to be a cornerstone to the Republican Party? Do we believe in some of the institutions that have held our political fabric together for more than 200 years? Do we believe in the president's tone versus a different one? I think that, you know, there's some real questions to be asked in terms of what it means to be a Republican these days that I think is important and worthy of a debate.
And again, we're going to get deep into those issues in a sec, but I want to pick up on just two of the things you've just pointed out there. One is this idea of an incumbent and being challenged and, you know, winning and losing, et cetera. You were primaried, if you like, last year, 2018, because President Trump supported your opponent in the primary for Congress. And he tweeted, "Mark Sanford has been very unhelpful to me in my campaign to MAGA. He is MIA and nothing but trouble. He's better off in Argentina. I fully endorse Katie Arrington for Congress in South Carolina, a state I love. She is tough on crime and will continue our fight to lower taxes. Vote Katie." Well, anyway, Katie won, and it's the only election you have ever lost. So are you not concerned that the president, you know, if he comes out for your opponents, and that it's going to be really tough for you?
Well, I think a couple things. One, that moment in time that you're describing was indeed a moment in time. And I think that there's been, frankly, erosion to much of the president's support since then. That's worthy of a conversation. But I first want to go back into the fact that what the president tweeted was I'd been not helpful to his cause. That's not the case. If you actually look at my voting pattern, I'm a very conservative Republican. I voted with the administration more than 90% of the time. And I think that this is, in essence, in a capstone, one of the real problems that many people have with the president, and I think that that discord is growing, and that is it's unbelievable and inconceivable in the world of business, in the world of education, military world, even in family life, to think that you could agree with somebody 90% of the time and not have them on your team. I mean, I love my brothers and sisters, but I don't agree with them all the time. I don't agree with them 90% of the time, but we still love each other. But in this instance, it is not an issue alliance. He wants personal loyalty. And that is a very different system than what we were raised in here in the United States in terms of being a nation of laws and not men. And so I think that part of our back and forth that has lasted for a number of years now is based on an issue of personal loyalty rather than issue loyalty, which is quite the departure from the American system.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other issue in that tweet is when the president said he's better off in Argentina. Now, you know what this means. He's referring to the values issue, the fact that there's a 10-year-old scandal around you in which you said you were, quote, on the Appalachian Trail, when in fact you weren't. You're in Argentina with your girlfriend. And you told the untruth or not the truth to your family, to your constituents, to the public. So some say that that's what you're best known for. Well, some political operatives in Iowa, for instance. Yeah, that's a lot of baggage.
Sure. Well, I mean, if I've got a carry-on bag, I think this president needs a private plane to carry on his baggage. But we won't go there. I think that there's a bigger issue, though, which is, indeed, an untruth was told on my behalf. And more importantly, I was living a lie in that chapter of my life. I fell in love with a woman I shouldn't have, but I did. And it was entailing the dissolution of a 20-year marriage. It was indeed 10 years ago. And I went on an apology tour here at home. And I believe in the Christian model of repentance and rebirth and a second chance at life. I've been on that journey. And what's most interesting about that story is in the wake of all that event 10 years ago, in the wake of that, the people who knew me best, the people who I'd represented here on the coast of South Carolina, where I grew up, they said, look, we don't approve of that chapter. We don't approve of how you handled it. But we know you and we trust you, and we want to send you to Washington, D.C. as our representative in Washington in the United States Congress. That's a very different story than the one that the president lives, where he says, I'm not sorry for anything I've done, though he lives in something of a glass house on that front. But will I be hit on that? Yes. I think the more instructive part for the voter out there is, did I learn from it? I think you can become a better person in the wake of failure in terms of humility and empathy and a whole other set of things that I think are important to relating to other people that I've certainly learned in the wake of that 2009 episode for me.
And as you point out, you were elected after that episode. But I want to ask you this because it, again, goes to the sort of values issues of politics in general. An associate of yours explained to Politico why you lost the congressional race, you know, the one that you were sort of primaried. And his about you, he says, he made a calculation in the post-Trump election that he was going to stand on principle. In this race, the ideas didn't matter nearly as much as whether he had been sufficiently loyal to the president in the eyes of the voter. So again now, Governor Sanford, you are standing on what you call the principle of conservative values, particularly fiscal values and others. Do you think that's going to be a winning strategy, standing on principle in this case?
If it's not, we're all in trouble. And so, I mean, I was not unaware of the danger of going against the president as I did when I was in the United States Congress. And I did it a handful of times. And from a voting standpoint, I overwhelmingly voted with the administration. But I did stand up on a couple things I disagreed on. And I said to my political folks, because they said, look, this is dangerous. I said, I get it. I know. I'm not unaware. But I've been granted a second chance in politics that very few are granted. And I owe it to my voters not to look for a fight, but if one comes along, not to back away from it, to just shoot it right down the middle. And that's what I did. And that's what I'm trying to do in this particular race, which is to say, look, here's some ideas that I believe in. Here's the data behind those ideas. Here's why I think they're important, will impact your life. And then let the voters draw their own conclusions. And I think that voters are weary of the promise one thing and do another. And it was the president who said, if you elect me, I will eliminate the debt over the 8 years that I might be in office. And instead, what we've seen is record numbers in terms of debt and deficit and spending the drive both.
Okay, so now we have to dive into this because this is really important. And we do find quite a lot of candidates, you know, saying one thing and doing another over these issues. You again have positioned yourself as the fiscal conservative fighting this ballooning debt and deficit. So you, though, did vote for the Republican massive tax cut bill of 2017. And as you know, because you know the figures better than I do, you're the expert. Since that bill went into effect, the U.S. budget deficit is growing by leaps and bounds. 40% deficit growth this year, even in a healthy economy. $1 trillion annual deficits for the first time since 2012, when the economy was, as you know, recovering from that major financial crisis. So I guess, again, there's sort of like a disconnect. How do you describe yourself as fiscally accountable when you vote for the thing that causes the deficits, these big tax cuts?
Well, I would respectfully disagree with you in that if you look at the numbers on the tax cuts, and I said at the time, I said, look, this is a mixed bag. Here are the pluses. Here are the minuses. The minus was if you look at our corporate tax environment relative to the rest of the industrialized world, at that time, the United States was not competitive. And so we had corporate inversions. We had corporate relocations, a lot of things that were job losing in complexion. And so the bet of former Speaker Paul Ryan, of Kevin Brady, of others who'd built the bill, and was ultimately based on a Democratic bill from Ron Wyden, actually from the West Coast, was how do we make our corporate structure more competitive, more inviting for capital around the world? And that was the base of the bill. And I said, okay, that's what we're aimed for, but, you know, it could be you have corporate buybacks, you could have a number of other things other than investment. I put out the pluses and the minuses. But if you look at the overall income stream to the federal government over the last 50 years, it's been about 18% of GDP. This bill did not materially change that. If it had, I would have voted against it. If you look at the overall numbers over the next 10 years, and I don't want to get too technical, but over the next 10 years, the federal government will take in, is projected to take in, $43 trillion. That's without the tax bill. With the tax bill, they'll take in $41.5 trillion. That's a 2.5% difference. And so you can be for or against the tax bill, but to blame, quote, the giant deficits on the tax bill, I don't think is accurate, because a 2.5% difference at the end of the day does not drive the train. And what I find particularly interesting about that are the number of people who will make great, you know, mileage and noise and whatnot about the tax bill, but not mention the fact that, oh, by the way, we're running a $1 trillion deficit. We've now had a multitude of Democratic debates and zero conversation on debt and deficit, and it's not being addressed on the Republican side, where the president's described himself as the king of debt and basically ruled out action on the very things that drive our debt and spending.
Yeah, I mean, you've identified a big issue. I just want to know, you said Paul Ryan, a speaker, made this bet about what corporations would do, but they didn't really invest to the extent that everybody hoped they would. And let me just read you. So do you think that was the wrong...
I think that's a fair point.
Okay. So that's good. You've said that's
a fair point.
So let me then read these things then. U.S. budget deficits, and we had this graph up. In 2016... on the last year of President Obama, the deficit was $585 billion. In the first year of President Trump, it was $666 billion in 2017. Then $804 billion when the tax cuts take effect in 2018. And it's projected at $896 billion in 2019. I mean, the picture tells the story.
Well, no, but that's not the whole picture. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the debt deal that was just signed, you know, a little more than a month ago, what it did was add $300 billion in new spending over the next 24 months to the federal coffer. The bill before that added roughly another $300 billion. That was the last debt deal where the president said, I'll never sign a bill like this again. And he signs one just a couple months later that's even worse. That bill added an additional $2 trillion of additional debt to the 10-year window. So, I would certainly cede the point that some of the erosion is based on the front end of the tax cut as they take effect, but a lot of it's based on spending. And if you look at the numbers, with or without the tax cut, we're going to unsustainable numbers in terms of our debt to GDP by any measure. And so the bet of the tax cut was, boy, we got to look at regulation, we got to look at corporate environment, we got to look at a whole host of different things that are important to growing the economy of the United States, so that we can avoid that. Because if we don't, with or without the tax cut, we're in real trouble based on, again, CBO and OMB projections.
Okay. Next, I want to go to some other issues. And I want to ask you this, because we've already established that it's a, you know, it's a pretty difficult thing to challenge an incumbent president. You're one of three. There's the former governor of Massachusetts, Bill Weld, and a former congressman of Illinois, Joe Walsh. Now, a Republican campaign, professional with experience in some of these primaries and other things, say that to run against President Trump, you have to kind of mount sort of a guerrilla insurgency campaign. You can't really fight like with like. What does that mean to you? Do you take anything from that piece of advice?
I'm only a couple of days into this. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that looks like. I do believe in Sun Tzu and the art of war and the notion of guerrilla and asymmetric warfare. I think it's going to be particularly important in this endeavor because you're right. I mean, they've got the high ground and they've got a lot of armament around that high ground. The question is, you know, how do we, again, affect voters and talk to voters on things that matter to their lives? I think we're on to something, given what happened in this very congressional district that you alluded to just a moment ago. The woman who beat me indeed beat me in the primary, but for the first time in about 50 years, this district went Democrat. And it did so in large measure because, soccer moms, working moms, suburban moms turned out in droves against the president. Young millennials did the same. And so I think that there are some groups out there that are disaffected with, in particular, the president's tone. That I think are worthy of conversation, and we're going to look for ways best to reach them.
So let me ask you a couple of other issues that are very front and center. Gun legislation, obviously, in the wake of this never-ending crisis of shooting sprees in the United States, obviously, you know, Congress, well, the Senate, Republican leaders are waiting to see what the president might say. There's been talk of background checks. There've been other things mentioned, but and a conversation between the president and some very important bipartisan senators. But nothing's come out yet. What is your position on sensible gun control legislation?
I would say that, you know, for most of your viewers, it's a little bit different just because America has a very different tradition in the way that we wrote the Second Amendment into the basic rights that go with being American, which you don't see in many other countries around the globe. But what I would say is there can be things that are done. I particularly like this notion of risk orders. it's being talked about and it's being massaged. But if you look at what tragically occurred in Parkland, it could have been avoided if people at the local level had been able to encroach, as you would with a domestic violence threat. And a local judge could say, no, you're going to lose on a temporary basis your Second Amendment right. I think that that's something that makes sense. And so I'm in favor of that as an added measure that's not currently on the billet. I've also come out in favor of what's known as the Charleston loophole. There's a 3-day kickout period currently wherein if you go to purchase a gun, it's not been processed, then you automatically can go purchase that gun, whether you've been identified or not within the federal registry. The idea of lengthening that slightly, I think, is something that makes sense as well.
And let me just ask you one other question. It's basically on foreign policy. As you know, President Trump fired his national security advisor. The national security advisor said he had quit. But nonetheless, he was known as a major hawk. Some might have nicknamed him Bombing Bolton. I don't know. But everybody knew that he had pretty interventionist ideas about various issues. And yet somebody like Mitt Romney, who does not agree with the president on much, supported John Bolton. Are you amongst those who would support a Bolton policy, or are you among those who might be breathing a sigh of relief that, he's not urging intervention in Iran and other such places?
I would say right outcome, but I don't agree with the way of getting there. I think that what you saw with the Bolton firing or departure or whatever it was is more of the same. And you look at the caliber of some of the people that have left this administration based on frustrations with the way in which it's just chaos there on a daily basis. I think it should raise alarm. I mean, one of the keys of executive branch is a degree of predictability, a degree of stability in knowing what will come next. And so whether it's with General Kelly or General Mattis or go down the list, a lot of noted and talented professionals have left the White House based on the mercurial element of the president's managerial or lack thereof style. And so I have a problem with the way in which it was done. As to Bolton's policies, I think that they have been too interventionist from my perspective. I believe that the declaration of war is rooted in Congress, and I think we've gotten away from that in the modern era wherein you have these looks like, feels like, seems like a war, but nobody calls it a war, and so you actually don't have declaration. I think that these operations need to run through the Congress. I think that there needs to be an authorization for the use of military force, and then the executive branch can be empowered. I think we have our system a bit backward here currently.
On that note, Governor Mark Sanford, challenging President Trump for the Republican nomination, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. Let us turn next to the much-needed politics of laughter as we celebrate a hugely successful professional and personal partnership. New fans of the beloved comic actor Lily Tomlin will know her from the hilarious Grace and Frankie on Netflix. But her signature role was perhaps in the Tony Award-winning play The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, a one-woman show written by her partner Jane Wagner. Their decades-long relationship has navigated extraordinary changing times, including, for instance, Time magazine in the 1970s trying to leverage a cover for a coming-out confession story by Lily. Now, a major retrospective is celebrating their work at Lincoln Center. It's called Two Free Women. And I spoke to the creative team of Tomlin and Wagner from Los Angeles as they prepared to fly cross-country for this much-deserved honor. Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, this is really an extraordinary privilege. It's an honor. Lily, you probably don't like hearing this stuff, but I did actually grow up watching you on television in Iran, if you can imagine.
I do like that.
And one of the first things I saw was Rona Martin's Laugh, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But what about this Lincoln Center retrospective for both of you? Two Free Women, Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner. Just both of you talk to me about just the title, Free Women.
Well, you know, that's the curators are Thomas Beard of Lincoln Center.
And Hilton Nails.
Hilton Nails, right, who writes for The New Yorker.
That must be the way they perceive us, don't you think?
They must perceive us as two free women. Otherwise, we would have taken a shy corner.
So let me then ask you, because this was obviously before you came out and before you got married. You've been married, but you've been life and work partners for, I think, nearly 50 years. And you both
really... Yes, very
really,
close.
Yeah, I mean, your creativity, your writing, your performing is so intertwined. I can even see you finishing each other's sentences right now. So how did people not know you were gay? Was it just not done? You couldn't acknowledge
well,
each
no,
other?
Well, no, I was gay, but I didn't meet Jane until 1971, mm-hmm. which was a year after I'd been on Laugh-In. And, no, of course it was, I mean, even Ellen came out in 1995. That was, they offered me the cover of Time at one point in 1975. But I didn't want to be on the cover just for being gay. I wanted to be on the cover for being
an artist,
right.
So they had said to you that we'll give you the cover if you come out for us?
Yeah, they needed a gay person. For an article in Time. And they used one. They got a service person. I think it was September of 75. And then I got the cover of Time with our first Broadway show, appearing nightly, which was in 77. And that was lovely. Although Jane and I were there all the time interviewing together because we were on the road preparing our show for Broadway. And
Lily was already famous before...
Jane was famous with the more discerning people.
Jane, do you think that had Lily done that cover for that reason in 1975, it might have actually been beneficial to the cause of LGBT, or was it just not possible at that time?
No, and we've talked about it together soon, and we think it should have been done, probably. It might have accelerated something, but then you don't want to think, well, it was so important either. But I think Lily was not quite as solid in your career, and you wanted not to be thought of...
Well, my mother was still living, too, I tried to protect her from too much publicity. Mm-hmm. She's a Southern girl. She was fundamentalist. And it would have been it was hard enough for her that her daughter had gone off to New York and was cavorting around and living with Jane and everything else. And my brother is gay also. And my mother almost had I'm sorry to talk about my personal life like this, but my mother just about collapsed when she found out my brother was gay. So a second blow from her elder, more sort of responsible daughter would have been a lot for her at that. She did know, and she loved Jane very much, but she just assumed the neighbors didn't carry on about it too much.
Well, I really appreciate you being so frank, and it's really important, I think, for lots of people to hear this and to see how, by and large, society has changed. I know there's still mm-hmm. obvious issues and problems and prejudices, but my goodness, society has taken such dramatic leaps forward. So let's go back, Lily, and let's play a little clip from Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, which, as Ernestine, the telephone operator, you created, I think, your first major big public impact. Here we go.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One ringy dingy. Two ringy dingies. A gracious good afternoon. Have I reached the party to whom I am speaking? This is Miss Tomlin of the telephone company. Have I reached a Mr. Aristotle Onassis? Mr. Nassis? I was wondering personally, what does the O stand for? Oh, my goodness. You Irishmen certainly do have a way with words.
Oh, my God. I'm just laughing watching it now. I mean, that is genuinely hilarious.
And I don't even remember calling Aristotle.
I don't even
I should have used his private number.
That was, you know, the major, you know, comedy show of the time. How did that propel
yes.
you? What did it do for you, and how much fun was it?
Well, it was absolutely, literally overnight. I aired on a Monday night. I was in New York because the show was already done some time before. And people saw me on the street, and they kind of recognized me as the new girl on the show. But many people didn't realize I was Ernestine. They would say, oh, you're the new girl on Laugh-In. Oh, you're so funny or cute or whatever they'd say. And then they'd say, and the girl that does the telephone operator, she's hilarious. I'd say, I do the telephone operator. And they would just be sort of nonplussed, you know. And I kind of had hated to tell them because they were so let down. They were kind of excited.
Yeah,
but people started...
And it still holds up. I mean, that comedy, it still does, you know, hold up. It hasn't perished on the vine at all. Appearing nightly was sort of women on, it's been described, on the spectrum of feminism, right? It wasn't about women versus men or whatever, but it was really looking at the difference between the way different women behaved in this sphere of feminism. Just describe for us a little bit. Take us back to the heart of that story.
Can you do that?
I can do it, but it'll kind of belie what Christiana is saying. What happened is I was doing one-nighters because I was so well-known from Laugh-In, and I just hated it. I wanted to sit down in a theater and do something for an extended run. And Jane said, well, you've got to legitimize yourself. You've got to go play a theater and have an extended run. So we began to put a show together, and we made the art. In those days, it was very hard to get a theater for a short run. And so we had the art. The art was ready to go. And we did all the preparatory stuff. And Jane said, you've got to have a title. And so she plumbed Appearing Nightly out of the air, N-I-T-E-L-Y. We felt that it was a compilation of just humans in the spectrum. We've always thought of it that way. You know, like Crystal the quadriplegic, and there was the 60s monologue, and so many different, and it was loosely tied together. So when we did the search, I'm just being so aggressive here and dominating the conversation. But when we did the search, Jane wrote that from scratch, and it was sort of stunning on Broadway at that time.
Because not much was being said about women.
No, and about reason. And all these different culture types. Of course, they were predominantly women, because I'm a woman, and it's easier for me to do women. I do a lot of men too, but not as definitively as I might women. And so when it came time to do the search, Jane surprised me out of nowhere. I was on the road and she sent me a bunch of pages, and it was almost all, it was Agnes Angst doing a huge performance piece, and it was Trudy the Bag Lady talking about a bunch of stuff. It was so wonderful. I just about died when I saw it. I said, this is so great. Just send me more stuff. Send me more stuff. And eventually she sent me the play.
Yeah, and this is a perfect place for me to play a clip from The Search, which, as we say, is the search for intelligent life in the universe. So let's play this clip. I'm not sure it's exactly the scene you were describing, but we'll talk about it.
In this chair, I role play Peter, right? In this chair, I role play myself. And in that chair, you role play the doctor. Peter, I am sick of the suppressive you do as I say macho number you have been putting me through. Now I'm me. Oh, no, I'm Peter. And I'd like just a glimpse of the nurturant female you and your butch rad femme friends harp on so much about. I want a woman, not a feminist. Aha, all it is with you is sex, sex, sex. And all it is with you is sex, sex, sexual politics. I have had it.
It really was ahead of its time, not only hilariously funny, but very pointedly political. And I think, Lily, you insisted on producing it, right? I mean, did you have to take ownership
of it? Well, yes, we had a lot of experience by that time. We had always produced ourselves on one-nighters. And so, yes, and I was so well-known that we could easily go and hit a town and we just leaflet. The show was just so wonderful. When we played it the final time, we were playing it in Santa Fe, I think, at the Lyric, weren't we? Something, or the first time, I can't remember. But we got the most wonderful letters from men especially. And it was a very feminist...
Well, that was the first time. That's when we knew that we had something.
Yeah, and we got all these great letters from two or three men. Well, it sounds like a bunch of letters, but there weren't that many people writing. So there were two or three people... And they were men, and they were very thoughtful and intelligent. And we said, Well, this is just, I couldn't believe it that we had scored with men that well.
And I had wanted to write something about consciousness, so we were using the feminist movement, of course, about consciousness. And it was wonderful to know that people were showing that they were getting that higher consciousness aspect of it.
You know, Lily, because you have been so famous in the public face of this couple, you, as you've said before, tend to, you know, dominate the conversation. You get all the glory. Yes. And I just want to ask Jane, what it's like to work in that kind of a couple. You're obviously 1,000% committed to each other and love each other and respect each other's, you know, professional qualities. But how do you, Jane, navigate that sort of tricky bit about Lily getting all the public glory?
Well, really, I just feel I've been very, very fortunate and very lucky to find somebody who loved my work that much and understood it. Although, as I say, it's getting a little more critical as we go along. But I feel like I was just very, very lucky to have this happen to me. Fairly early after JT, I wasn't sure what I would do. And then to have the whole world of Lily through comedy open up, it was such a gift. Now, today, I'd have to write about dark narcissism, I guess. And, you know, so it wouldn't be quite...
Not on my front.
Not on my front? No. But
sort of light gray.
No. And I didn't mean to imply that you're a dark narcissist. You're a narcissist, but not anywhere near dark.
So let's talk about this incredible film, 9 to 5, that you did with the other Jane, Lily, Jane Fonda. And it's so ahead of its time, and it still holds up, because it's, you know, resonated with all the sort of Me Too issues, you know, so many years later. Let's just play this clip.
Excuse me. Could you tell me where the coffee shop is, please?
What?
The coffee shop.
The coffee shop? No, I'm new here. I don't drink coffee.
I'm new here, too. Where do you work?
Downstairs.
In the morgue.
That's right.
Denise.
Yes, yes.
How did he?
Coffee. Too much coffee. I'm just taking him out for some air. I mean, some fresh air for me. He's just coming along for the ride. What?
You're a doctor. I didn't see your badge. Sorry.
I'm a doctor. So why the hell am I talking to you? Piss off.
So again, you know, it changed the landscape at the time. But Lily, apparently you didn't really like parts of the script at the beginning. What did you like and what changed?
Oh, I don't want to say that because it wouldn't.
Did they make your part bigger?
No, but the line stayed in the script and they got quite a big reaction in the theater.
Okay. And I think there's going to be a sequel maybe. There's certainly a play on in
London right now. We're working on that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's fast forward now to what is, again, all the rage, which you again seem to be, along with Jane Fonda, on the cutting edge, and that is love, life, sex with the older woman, or for the older woman, Gracie and Frankie and Grace, which has absolutely, you know, taken everyone by storm. I'm going to play a clip of that.
And I mean, shouldn't older women have it better than that?
Couldn't we fight for the right to masturbate after lunch?
Seriously, Mom, how do I explain to my children that their grandma makes sex toys for other grandmas?
I'll tell you what you can tell them, honey. We're making things for people like us because we are sick and tired of being dismissed by people like you.
Mic drop. Let's go home.
Oh, if you guys are going, I should probably go with you.
No, you're going to have to do your mom and coyote time somewhere else. Because we got a lot going on at our house.
Yeah.
Tell me, Lily, what was that like, and how much fun did you have with Jane Fonda?
Oh, we have a lot of fun. We really, Jane and I are very good friends, and Grace and Frankie sort of dropped out of the sky right into our laps. Marta made up created the show, Marta and Howard, and she had us in mind. She had Jane and me in mind for the parts. And so my agent called and said, are you and Jane looking to do something on television? And I said, well, we are now, because I knew that meant somebody had called him. Anyway, so yeah, we've done six seasons, and we're going to go back and do our seventh. And I think today they're announcing that it's our seventh season and our final.
Jane Wagner and Lily Tomlin, thank you so much and congratulations on this honor.
Thank you. We're very excited and very pleased.
And today, that retrospective, Two Free Women, opens at Lincoln Center in New York. Early in the program, we addressed America's staggering deficit. And students know a lot about debt. On average, a graduate racks up $28,000. But is it worth it? In his new book, The Years That Matter Most, author Paul Tough reminds us that the university system is already tilted towards the wealthy. And he sat down with our Michelle Martin to discuss how inequality has come to define higher education.
Paul Tough, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The big story for, I think, the rest of the public is this college admission scandal where celebrities were literally making up profiles of their kids, paying huge sums of money as bribes. What did you think?
I think by that, the time that had happened, I had been so immersed in talking to admissions people who can be a little, I mean, in lots of ways they're very idealistic, but they can also be a little bit skeptical or even cynical about how the admissions process works, that I wasn't all that surprised. I mean, obviously, like, the details are crazy and incredibly surprising, that the depths or lengths that certain parents will go to. But that sort of worldview that higher admissions is this cutthroat competition, that there are no rules, that you can do whatever you want, that it's an unfair system, and our only job as parents is to, like, get the unfairness to work for us instead of for somebody else. I think that pervades a lot of admissions, and especially admissions at the most selective institute.
I don't know if you intend this, but in a way you sound like this is a moral failing of the upper middle class and the wealthy, that they've sort of changed their minds and just said college is about aggregating more of what we already have.
I started from the premise that things were out of whack, and I thought I could find, like, yeah, this was the person, this was the moment, this was the organization that had thrown things off. And it's really not that way. I mean, I feel like things have changed in this country in general over the last few decades. In an earlier era, we did believe in collective good more than we do today. We're much more competitive. We're much more, I think it's an angrier time than it has been in the past. And I think that plays out in higher education as well. So, you know, like, who is to blame where it started? I don't even think just saying, like, this is an upper middle class problem is fair. That class certainly is the one that they make the headlines. But it's not just about them. I mean, the real problem when I look at higher education, it's the public institutions, the public sector, where things have really fallen down. And that's all of our responsibility.
How does that play out?
So the big picture is that over the last couple of decades, since 2001, we have cut per student public funding on higher education by about 16% across the country, adjusted for inflation. So that's like a big cut, right? And it's a big cut at a moment where all of the signs from the economy and from the labor market are that our young people need more higher education, not less. So that's what we've been doing as the public. What effect that has had on our institutions, I think, is two things. So at the more selective public institutions, the flagship institutions like University of Michigan, University of Virginia, the sort of the great public flagships in this country, they have been behaving more like private institutions. So they are taking more students from out of state. They are charging more. They are using the same kind of admissions metrics, putting more focus on admitting kids with high SAT scores. And as a result, they are like private institutions, educating more rich kids and fewer low-income kids. Then when we're talking about less selective institutions, and there are a lot of those public institutions that are less selective, community colleges and regional public universities that are mostly designed to take anybody who wants to show up, the problem there is just that we're not giving them enough money to do their job. We're spending much less on a year of community college than we're spending on a year of high school. So the public's like, okay, we're going to spend a lot of money on you, or a decent amount of money on you when you're 15 and 16 and 17, and then, like, you're 18 and 19, and suddenly your education is...
Why is that? Because we didn't think they were important?
I think that we just think about higher education differently than we think about K-12 education. That we think, we still have this idea in our head, and I think we feed it ourselves, the media feeds it as well, that, like, yeah, up to high school is real, like, public education, right? But then after that, it's like extra. It's a luxury, right? Anything that happens after that. And that is a moment where kids are supposed to just fend for themselves. They're supposed to pay for themselves. They're supposed to figure it out for themselves. It's not really the jobs of the institutions to help them graduate. I think in some places that is starting to change, but we've drawn that line, and that line doesn't really make any sense. It doesn't make any sense that we would just say, you know, after you turn 18, your education is your own responsibility, and partly because a high school education is not enough. Like, there's just no question that you cannot just, with a high school education, get achieve the building blocks of a middle class life.
So why don't we talk about the kids, some of the kids you spend time with. Right. You know, I'm sure you interviewed a whole bunch of people and you chose to focus on a few because they illustrate some of the points that you want to make. So why don't you just tell me about a few of them and tell me why their stories are so important.
Sure. So in the very first chapter of the book, I describe this one remarkable, sad afternoon that I spent with a young woman named Shannon from the Bronx, who was going to high school in Harlem and was an unbelievable student who had worked incredibly hard in her last couple of years of high school, especially to get into an Ivy League school. That was her goal. She'd sort of been focused on it with incredible determination. And so I was with her at the moment that she was going to hear, you now hear, I haven't understood this on your phone, instead of getting an envelope in the mail. And what was incredible to me about that moment was not just, you know, her waiting for those results and getting those results, but was her coming to terms with that idea that this whole question of whether mobility works, whether higher education works, whether it's a meritocracy, was for her playing out at that particular moment.
But how old is she? 17 at the time?
17, 18.
So here's a 17-year-old basically saying, my whole life hangs in the balance. Spoiler alert, she's already been admitted to another school.
Yeah.
With a full ride. Not an Ivy, but a very fine school.
Yeah. There was a part of me that wants to do what us adults often want to do, which is to say, oh, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal, right? Because I think the reality is whether you're at a super ultra-exclusive institution or just an ultra-exclusive institution doesn't make a huge difference, and she's putting way too much pressure on herself. So, yes, all that was true. But what was important to me about that moment as well, and I had just come from spending time with this economist in Silicon Valley named Raj Chetty, who'd been studying mobility, is that she was kind of right in all these important ways, that especially for low-income students, what kind of institution you get to really does have a big impact on the trajectory of your life.
So she was right in all these important ways. It's not just about going to college. It's where you go to college.
Yeah, I think what happens to you in college makes a huge difference. I think the difference between, you know, for her it was Penn and Davidson, I don't think that makes or breaks us. I think Shannon is going to be great no matter where she goes, right?
Okay, but generally speaking, I take your point that you don't want to tie the whole policy to one kid.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is, generally speaking, because you looked at and you talked to people with huge data sets.
Yes, it really does make a difference where you go to college, absolutely. And what makes a bigger difference for me is that when you look at those institutions, the institutions that, you know, the data shows are the most, do the most to help your social mobility, do the most to help your future earnings, those institutions are almost entirely populated by rich kids, by kids who grew up in the top economic quintile. And that kids like Shannon mostly aren't going to, you know, the Penns or the Davidsons, they're mostly going to community colleges or non-selective public institutions that we have totally underfunded.
One of the things that I appreciate, though, about is that, you know, and I want to be very clear that, you know, poor and minority are not synonyms, okay?
Yes.
But I do, one of the things I found fascinating was that there are lots of programs out there or different strategies out there to try to diversify these campuses and attract kids from different economic backgrounds. And, you know, there are white kids who don't feel particularly comfortable on these campuses. Can you just tell the Kim story? And the reason I just found that fascinating, because Kim is a white kid who didn't feel all that comfortable either. Could you talk a little bit about her story and why it matters?
For sure. I mean, this was some of the reporting to me that was the most interesting that I got to do, was in this town called Taylorsville, which is in the Appalachian foothills in western North Carolina. And it's almost all white, almost all Republican, and not a lot of money in this county or in this town at all. And so Kim was this young person who was, like a lot of the kids I talked to, super ambitious, working really hard. But when it came time to apply to college, she did not have a family structure that was supporting her at all. Her parents and extended family weren't going to pay any money for her school. And they also, like, weren't very supportive. She had uncles telling her, like, college is a waste of time. You should just join the Marines like everybody else in the family, saying they wouldn't pay for anything. Mm-hmm. And this was really like hard on Kim on all sorts of levels. It obviously was hard financially and practically, but it was also hard emotionally, right? To not have, like, it's one thing when you're achieving that social mobility and changing where you came from, but you have a push from behind from your family. That wasn't her experience at all. And I think it made things even harder. And she was, I mean, part of what made reporting with her so interesting is that she was really open about the kind of family strife that she was going through and these little fights that she was having with her brothers and with her mom as they were trying to figure out, like, do you belong? Are you part of the family? Do you want to be part of the family? Are you trying to leave us? Are you trying to leave Taylorsville? Yeah. Are you trying to leave our class? Like, that stuff just goes really deep, I think.
You know, you've got a message for lower income kids or kids from different backgrounds that aren't so advantaged. I mean, part of your message is don't lose hope, right?
Yeah.
But what's your message for people who are from these backgrounds already, who are middle class and, you know, upper middle class? I mean, the people who are probably listening to this program are probably more likely to think, I don't feel I'm rich. I've done the best I could. It's not that I want my kid to be super rich. I just don't want my kid to be poor.
Yeah.
Okay? So what's your message to them? I mean, is it just don't opportunity hoard? I mean, you have a message that isn't just about, you know, your moral hazard or whatever.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, not only is it just not fair to say, like, it's all your fault, parents, but it also is not effective. It's not an effective way to change, to blame individual parents, especially when they feel so caught up in this systemic pressure to help their kids, right? It's totally natural to want to help your kids as much as you can. But I think two things. One is that I think understanding what you're doing, understanding if you are an upper middle class or upper class parent, that the higher education system is already tilted in your favor, right? Even if it constantly feels unfair to you and fair to the kid down the block, it is already tilted in your favor. So at least be mindful of that. And then at the same time that you are trying to help your kids do well, I think understand that you can change the system in all the ways that we change systems, the way we vote, what we say to the institutions, you know, where we work, or if we're an alumni of a institution, or if we're a parent, or if we're a student. There are ways that we can try to pressure them to change. And I really think that both those things can happen at the same time.
Who are you saying is rich? Are you talking about, you know, Lori Loughlin Rich, who's alleged to have, you know, given some guy $500,000 to get her kid into the school of her choice? Or are you talking to a dentist married to a teacher?
I mean, when you look at Raj Chetty's data, like the top, so he talks about the top economic quintile, the top 20% of families who are well off, right? And I think a lot of those top 20% do not feel particularly well off. And partly that's just a natural sort of American or human reaction. Like, we always can see the person who's making a little bit more than us, and they're rich and we're not rich. But I think that it's important for those of us who are in that top economic quintile to recognize, like, being in a top economic quintile, whatever the number is, whatever your expenses are, that means something. You are in the top economic quintile, right? So you're in it, you have privileges that the other 80% of the country doesn't have.
One of the things about your book, though, is you talk about that other top 20% quintile and what that's like for their kids, right? Mm-hmm. And tell me about that.
It's hard too. I mean, I feel like I spent more time, I think, with low-income kids. But there was this one SAT tutor in Washington D.C. named Ned Johnson. I spent a bunch of time in his tutoring centers in Washington. He makes $400 an hour. He's an exceptional.
Wait, to say that? $400 an hour?
And he's worth it. He's an exceptional.
Are we in the wrong business?
I think we're in the wrong business. I don't know that we could do this as well as Ned does, though. And he's amazing. Watching him work was this incredible privilege because he's really good at his job. And a lot of what he does in his job is tries to calm down these incredibly stressed out, affluent kids who he tutors. So when I was there, I felt like I was understanding two things. One is I was understanding that this admission system isn't fair even before you get to, you know, Lori Loughlin and you know, photoshopping your kid's face on a water polo player. It's like the degree to which these kids' test scores were improving because of the tutoring they were getting was remarkable. They were getting all sorts of opportunities that they didn't have before they walked in and started paying $400 an hour. So any system that bases their admissions on that, whether you can afford Ned, is by definition not fair, right? But then I felt like I was having this other experience, which is like the actual students who were there, they were great. They were like these really super hardworking, very intense young people. I liked them all. But they... The one thing that sort of linked them all together is they were under enormous stress, you know, that they had dedicated, at the very least, the last couple of years of high school, in some cases much more, to this relentless pursuit of one number, what their SAT or ACT score was, and that was in pursuit of one school, usually, or one set of schools. And so there were lots of ways that their lives, in that way, were a lot like Shannon's, the mm-hmm. young woman from the Bronx. You know, they were all stressed out. And it's, you know, the stakes were different, the uh-huh. opportunities were different, the experience was not that different.
Partly the problem here is that you've got too many people competing for a scarce resource. As part of your problem is it shouldn't be scarce.
Yeah, I mean, I think our choice to make higher education scarce is a choice, right? And other at other moments in American history, we've chosen differently, and other countries right now are choosing differently. There has been, at certain points in the American past, this moment where technology changes and the workplace changes and communities get the message, our kids need more education. And we responded in the past in this pretty rational way, not to say, like, well, let's ration it and figure out how we can get it for our kids and not give it to other kids, but to say, like, okay, our community needs more education, we're going to build. I write about this thing called the high school movement in the early 20th century, where suddenly workplaces changed, communities realized that kids need high school education, and all over the country, communities built free public high schools. And in just 30 years, we went from having about 9% of kids getting high school degrees to about 50% of kids getting high school degrees. It was this huge change, and it made sense. And there weren't a lot of fights about, like, who should go to high school and who shouldn't. It was just understood. This was a collective good. And the same thing is happening right now, where there are all the signs from the economy, from the labor marketplace, are that our kids need more education, and we are responding now in this very different way. In the message that we're sending to these students is, you're on your own. This is not our job to take care of this. This is your own problem. Mm-hmm. And that's just a different kind of response. It's a different kind of, I mean, it's a much less American response, in my opinion. It's a much less... It's a much less collective response. It's just we've forgotten this idea that higher education, public higher education, benefits everybody.
Paul Tough, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for now. Thanks for watching. Goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.